Welcome back to another evening of Word Temple. This is your host, Catherine Hastings. To be true, my heart spoke like a child. Francie Jammes. 100 years ago, this poet of the French Pyrenees politely turned his back to the poetic movement du jour, known as symbolism, and wrote from his own heart. Tonight, we celebrate a translation of his work that clearly comes from the heart as well, the heart of Jeanine Cannon. She is an award-winning author of 17 books of poetry, anthologies, translations, stories, and essays, and now the translator of Under the Azure, poems of Francie Jammes, work that struck his contemporary, André Gide, as pure audacity for its childlike expression. He said, "You don't read Francie Jammes, you breathe him." Stéphane Mallarmé, perhaps the most famous symbolist poet, admired Jammes for his delicate, tactful, naive, and unerring verse with its exquisite network of voices. If you are as ignorant to the life of Jammes as I was until recently, fear not. Cannon has included in this translation a riveting introduction that carries you from his birth in 1868 in the 150-million-year-old Pyrenees mountain range, past Picasso's portraits in pink and blue, into Impressionism, onward to the poet's stunning epiphany in 1895, "I do not know why I did not die from the blast of that violet wing," through a war in which he served as ambulance administrator all the way to his death in 1938 of colon cancer, a death that came as he predicted, like a young hawk on a hair blanched by many winters. And after all this, you have the poetry. The poetry appears in both French and English. Cannon states that Jammes dwelt deep in the land of feeling. His poetry, earthy as slugs, lofty as the highest mountain peaks, never fails to show us the beauty God gives to ordinary life. She calls him the poet of an ever-fresh innocence, a magician who dematerialized himself in the inner life of the world. And thanks to her, we are all gifted with the words and illuminations he discovered there. "Leave the bitter world," he says, "and come to the cell of my meditations, where you can hear living waters flow under the mint consumed by the sun." Here now is Jeanine Cannon.
Thank you very much, Catherine, and thank you for the beautiful introduction to Francie Jammes. People often ask me about the name Jammes. It's spelled J-A-M-M-E-S, and it derives most likely from the Hebrew name Jacob, which became Jammes as it reached the southern France, and then James once it had arrived in England. "The essence of Jammism," said his biographer Mallet, "is tenderness, purity, mysticism, and a love of nature that saturates all this sweet feeling with the smell of the earth." Indeed, Jammes is a poet of nature, of love, and a truly spiritual poet who speaks to our longing today for greater spirituality in poetry. Whatever his subject, Jammes attends with a purity, simplicity, and integrity of spirit that allows him to commune directly with the very essence and power of life. Jammes worshipped God in life. He was born in a very small village high in the Pyrenees, the mountains that divide France from Spain, just 10 years after Bernadette was born at Lourdes and had her vision of the Lady in White. He went to school in that region and started writing poetry in his teens. He failed his baccalaureate, but he went on immediately to have printed his own first collection of poems called Me, and then discovered by Mallarmé and André Gide, the novelist, and Pierre Loti. He was aided in getting a first true volume published called Verses. As Catherine mentioned, Jammes' work appeared at the peak of the Belle Époque, that magnificent period And I'd like to read a page from my own introduction. Jean's first work appeared in the 1890s at the height of the Belle Époque. In 1894, the same year that Verses was published, a small feminine face finally sculpted from a 25,000-year-old ivory mammoth tusk had been unearthed near a cave at Brassampuis in the Pyrenean foothills. It was and still is the oldest representation of a human face in the world. On the south side of the Pyrenees in Spanish Catalonia, Picasso was painting his portraits in pink and blue. On the north side in French Catalonia, Mayol was starting to sculpt strong bronze women, while near the Mediterranean, arthritic old Renoir was absorbed in his voluptuous female bathers, and to the north, Monet was designing the sumptuous Giverny gardens he would be painting for decades. Impressionism was in full radiance. Proust was ruminating remembrance of things past. Bergson was concocting creative evolution, and Mallarmé composing his final masterpiece, A Roll of the Dice Will Never Abolish Chance. In Ireland, the last of the Romantics, W.B. Yeats, born just 3 years before Jam, was singing his sublime dreams to Maud Gonne. And from across the Atlantic, the lanky, free, open, optimistic verse of Walt Whitman was striking a deep chord on the continent. As the 19th century rolled into the 20th, a brief golden era produced phenomenal creativity and innovation. The invention of the automobile, the telephone, the phonograph, the motion picture, the airplane and the subway, the birth of modern Einsteinian physics, Kochian medical microbiology, Freudian psychology, and modern Picassoan art, even the Norwegian Nobel Prize. The French Empire had attained, alas, its greatest expansion. It was the peak of the French Empire, in fact. I'd like to read you a poem from his first major collection called From the Morning Angelus to the Evening Angelus, a volume of poetry that became widely renowned in France and made his reputation. Do you remember, love, the day the meadows turned stony? And the valleys were wet with light, and the mountains had the color of those balsamic liqueurs the monks make. It was evening, and I could feel my heart expanding out toward the snow on the tall golden green peaks, and tears came to my eyes, imagining the land of childhood, there toward pure cold air, toward dense snows, toward the mountain people, the shepherds, the sheep, toward the goats and the watchdogs and the wooden flutes shining from calloused hands, toward the raucous bells of grazing flocks, toward the sluice waters, the sad gardens, the gentle presbyteries, the kids who followed singing the conscripts, who sang toward the summer waters, the white fish with red fins, toward the fountain in the square of the village where I was a sad, good little boy. One of his early dreamy love lyrics, the house would be full of roses. The house would be full of roses and wasps. In the afternoon, we would hear the bell ringing for vespers. Under the slow-moving shade, grapes the color of translucent stone would appear asleep in the sun. How I would love you there, offering my whole heart of 24 and my spirit of mockery, my pride and my poetry of white roses, even if I do not know you and you do not exist. I only know that if you were alive and with me at the bottom of the meadow, we would be laughing and kissing under the golden bees by the cool stream in the dense leaves. We would hear only the heat of the sun, and when the shade of the hazels covered your ear, our mouths would mingle and stop laughing. to speak of our love that can never be spoken. And I would find on the red of your lips the taste of golden grapes, red roses, and wasps. Jaume also wrote a dozen novellas. He wrote 800 poems throughout his life. And he had a correspondence with most of the notable authors of his day, Colette, Claudel, Gide, Mallarmé, Mauriac, and St. John Peirce, as well as having a significant influence on contemporary writers abroad, including Jiménez and Unamuno in Spain, Rilke in Austro-Hungary, and Amy Lowell and Rex Roth in the United States. Rex Roth, in fact, said that he thought that perhaps Jean was the greatest unknown influence on American 20th century poetry, a thought to ponder. I'd like to read a poem that he wrote in one of his early collections that really gives you a feeling for the era in which he lived. She attends the school. She attends the school of the Sacred Heart, that beautiful girl, so white. She comes in a small carriage under the branches during vacation when the flowers bloom. She descends the hill gently. The carriage is old and small. She is not very rich and reminds me of the old families 60 years ago, cheerful, good, and honest. She reminds me of the schoolgirls then with their rococo names, names of books given as prizes, green, red, and olive, with an oval ornament, the title in gold. Clara de les Beaux, Eleonore d'Erval, Victoire d'Etremont, Laure de la Vallée, Lia Fauchereuse, Blanche de Percival, Rose de Limereuil, and Sylvie Laboulaye. I think of those schoolgirls during vacation on farms still productive, eating green apples and rancid hazelnuts in front of a peacock in the cool shady park with gilded iron gates. It was one of those houses with an open table. Many dishes were served and everyone laughed. Through the window we saw the green lawn, and when the sun went down the pane sparkled. And then a handsome young man married the schoolgirl, a very beautiful girl, pink and white, who laughed on the bed when he kissed her hip, and knowing how to make them, they had many children. The dining room. There is a faintly glowing cupboard that has heard the voice of my great aunts, heard the voice of my grandfather, heard my father's voice, and to their memory is faithful. Do not assume she is always silent, for we talk. There is also a wooden cuckoo. I do not know why he has no voice. I do not want to ask. Perhaps quite simply it broke, the voice that was in the spring, like the voice of the dead. There is an ancient buffet, too, scented with beeswax, preserves, meat, bread, and ripened pears. He's a loyal servant who understands he must never steal anything. Many men and women who do not believe in these little souls have visited me, and whenever a visitor enters and says, "How are you, Monsieur Jaume?" I smile. They think I live alone. Now, from the next volume that he put out, Primroses in Mourning, which includes his prayers and his elegies, I'd like to read one short prayer called Prayer to Be Simple. The butterflies surrender to each breath of air, like the flower petals tossed toward you at processions by gentle little children. My God, it is morning. Already prayers are rising toward you with flowery butterflies, the crow of the cock and blows of stone cutters. under the luminous green palms of plane trees. In this month of July, when earth is crackling, we hear grinding cicadas we cannot see, diligently chanting your omnipotence. The restless blackbird in the dark river foliage tries to whistle but doesn't quite dare. He doesn't know what troubles him. He perches, suddenly darts and skims ground to the other side where there is no one. So gently life begins again today, as yesterday and so many times before. Like these butterflies, like these workers, like these sun-devouring cicadas, and these blackbirds hidden in the cold dark leaves, let me, O my God, continue to live my life as simply as possible. Now I'd like to read you Jam's Rosary, a masterpiece poem written after he went through a sort of dark night of the soul, and then after his happy, rather pagan childhood, he converted to Catholicism. But this is Jam's own Hail Mary. It became a very famous poem by a song, excuse me, by the well-known singer Georges Brassens, called Prayer. Prayer was based on just a couple of stanzas from this poem. I'd like to read the poem in its entirety. I call it Hail Mary. Annunciation. By the rainbow over a shower of white roses, by the new thrill spreading through the branches that made the shoot of Jesse flower, by the annunciations laughing in the dew, and by the lowered eyelids of solemn fiancés, I salute you, Mary. Visitation. By the exaltation of your humility and the joy of the humble hearts you visit, by the Magnificat launched from a thousand nests, by your lily hands pointing toward the Holy Spirit, and by Elizabeth, trellis trembling with fruit, I salute you, Mary. Nativity. By the donkey and the cow, the shadow and the straw, by the poor woman told to go away, by the births marked only by graves with bouquets of frost and dove feathers, by the virtue that struggles and the virtue that fails, I salute you, Mary. Purification. By your modest offering of turtle doves, by old Simeon weeping in front of the altar, by Anne the prophet and Anne your mother, by the unknown carpenter bent over his cane, quietly following a donkey's little steps, I salute you, Mary. Finding our Lord in the temple, by the mother learning that her son is cured, by the bird calling to the bird fallen from the nest, by the thirsty grass drinking in the rain, by the kiss that is lost and the love found again, and the beggar rediscovering his lost coin, I salute you, Mary. Agony. By the little boy who dies at his mother's side, while children play in the garden, by the wounded bird who doesn't understand why his wing starts bleeding and drops, by the thirst and the hunger and the burning frenzy, I salute you, Mary. Flagellation. By the kids beaten when the drunk comes home, by the donkey kicked in the belly, by the humiliation of the innocent who are punished, by the virgin sold and stripped, by the son whose mother was insulted, I salute you, Mary. Crown of thorns. By the beggar who has never had any crown but the flight of hornets, fond of the yellow orchards, nor any scepter but a stick to drive away dogs. By the poet whose brow is bleeding, circled in the bramble of desires he never attains, I salute you, Mary. Bearing the cross. By the old woman stumbling beneath her burden who cries, O Lord, by the poor wretch whose arms had no human love to lean on, like the sun's cross on Simon of Cyrene. By the horse crushed under his wagon, I salute you, Mary. Crucifixion. By the four directions that crucify this world, by all whose flesh is broken or succumbs, by those with no feet and those with no hands, by the sick man groaning in surgery, by the just man convicted of murder, I salute you, Mary. Resurrection. By the night that passes and shows us again, the wild rose laughing on the heart of the dawn, by the Easter bells ringing in full momentum on Holy Saturday, filling the mouth of the valley with hallelujahs, I salute you, Mary. Ascension. By the hermit's steep climb toward the summit where the white partridges dwell, by the herds that scale the heavenly dawn to feed on nothing but honeyed snow, and by the ascent of the glorious sun, I salute you, Mary. Pentecost, by the shepherd fires that shine at night on the faces of the hills, those praying apostles, by the flame that cooks the poor man's dark soup, by the lightning with which the Spirit lights like thatch, but for all eternity, the void of every human being, I salute you, Mary. Assumption, by the old woman who reaches with her load of wood, the top of the road and the shadow of the cross, whose most beautiful son comes to help her in her pain, by the dove whose flight toward the light dissolves and becomes pure prayer, I salute you, Mary. Crown of the Holy Virgin, by the queen who has never had any crown, but the stars, treasure of ineffable alms, nor any scepter, but the lily from an old garden, by the virgin whose face leans over, circled in the roses of desires, her love attains. I salute you, Mary. To conclude, I'd like to read a very short poem written in his late years. He created a collection of poems dedicated to local springs in the Pyrenees Mountains, springs that he loved and knew well. I'll read the translation first and then conclude with the poem the way Jean wrote it in French. The Purifying Spring. Drop by drop, the rock, full of flowers and green, pours out its heart. I see, I hear it streaming over rocky debris alongside the road. Thousands of pendants of sparkling water dazzle on the broken shale and quickly pass, replaced in an instant by their sisters of ice. It rains and it rains, and with each pelting, the flower moves with the moss. So gently it rains and rains underneath the blue sky. La source qui filtre. La roche, goutte à goutte, toute pleine de fleurs, dans la verdure, verse son cœur. Je vois, j'écoute son ruisselet sur les boulis bordant la route. C'est par milliers qu'on voit briller au schiste en loc les pans de loc du lustre d'eau qui vite passe et que remplace tout aussitôt les leurs de glace. Il pleut, et par ce coup, la fleur s'émeut avec la mousse. Il pleut, de façon douce, sous le ciel bleu. Thank you.
Il revient à ma mémoire des souvenirs familiers. Je revois ma blouse noire lorsque j'étais écolier. Sur le chemin de l'école, je chantais à pleine voix des romances sans paroles, vieilles chansons d'autrefois. Douce France, cher pays de mon enfance, bercé de tendre insouciance, je t'ai gardé dans mon cœur. Mon village, aux clochers, aux maisons sages, où les enfants de mon âge ont partagé mon bonheur. Oui, je t'aime et je te donne ce poème. Oui, je t'aime dans la joie ou la douleur. Douce France, cher pays de mon enfance, bercé de tendre insouciance, je t'ai gardé dans mon cœur. Oui, je t'aime et je te donne ce poème. Oui, je t'aime dans la joie ou la douleur. Douce France, cher pays de mon enfance, bercé de tendre insouciance, je t'ai gardé dans mon cœur. Je t'ai gardé dans mon cœur.
That was the French singer Charles Trenet, and before that, Janine Cannon read from her new book of poems, Under the Azure, Poems of Francie Jammes. Paul Hoover was initially scheduled to appear on tonight's program reading from his new book, Sonnet 56. He will be returning to Word Temple in a couple of months instead. Up next, we are going to talk about Sylvia Plath for a while, and I'll be airing some poems read by her that I have not played on this program before. And it's also time for me to remind you that you are listening to Word Temple on KRCB 91.1 FM. This is Catherine Hastings. Sylvia Plath. Although I suspect that anyone listening to the show is familiar with Plath's history and work, here is a synopsis of her life as a reminder. Plath was born an American poet, novelist, and short story writer, born in October 1932 in Massachusetts. Her first poem appeared in the Boston Herald when she was just 8 years old, and she later won a scholarship to attend Smith College. From about 1944 on, Plath kept a journal that she would use for inspiration for poems and stories. In 1953, she was hoping to be admitted to a Harvard summer class on writing. When she wasn't accepted, it hit her hard. That August, she left a note that said, "Have gone for a long walk. Will be home tomorrow." She took a blanket along with a bottle of sleeping pills down to her cellar. She crept into a crawl space under the porch, took the pills, and became unconscious. 2 days later, she was found with 8 sleeping pills still in the bottle. She recovered enough to begin attendance at Smith College in the spring. This, apparently, is when her poetry took giant leaps forward. She graduated from Smith summa cum laude and won a Fulbright scholarship to study at Cambridge University, England. Skipping ahead in her story a bit, Plath had a hard time dealing with the winter weather in England and began falling ill and experiencing depression, deep depression. One day she bought a copy of the St. Botolph's Review that featured work by, among others, the poet Ted Hughes. That same evening, she attended a party celebrating the publication of the book and met Hughes. Their meeting is one of the most well-known meetings of two aspiring poets of the 20th century. According to her journals and letters, they danced and stamped and yelled and drank, and then he kissed her on the neck and she bit him on the cheek, drawing blood. She wrote the poem Pursuit to him. In this poem, she announced with some chilling effect that, quote, one day I'll have my death of him, unquote. They were married on Bloomsday in 1956. Plath began typing and sending out Hughes' poems to publishers in America and England as soon as they met. Due in part to her efforts, Hughes won the first prize in the New York Poetry Center contest of 1957 that was judged by Marianne Moore, W.H. Auden, and Stephen Spender, a contest he was apparently unaware that he had even entered. Back in Massachusetts, Plath and Hughes decided to leave their jobs in academia and turn to a life of writing. But the new year, 1958, developed into a stressful one of their relationship. On the last day of school, Hughes was to meet Plath right after her last class, but she couldn't find him anywhere. After looking in various places, she eventually saw him coming up a path with a young female student who ran off as soon as she saw Plath. The quarrels began. In 1959, Plath became pregnant, and the couple moved back to England as Hughes wanted the child born on his native soil. Their first child, a girl named Frida, was born on April 1st. In February 1961, Plath suffered a miscarriage and had an appendectomy that left her hospitalized for a number of weeks. It was the experience of being hospitalized that put her in a writing frenzy that produced her famous poem, Tulips, which you'll hear her read little later in the show. In 1961, Plath completed some of her most famous poems, including The Surgeon at 2 a.m., Morning Song, Insomniac, and others. In January 1962, Plath and Hughes had a son, Nicholas Farrar. She began writing her aerial poems, considered by many to be the best poems of her career. By spring of that same year, she became increasingly suspicious that Ted Hughes was having an affair. At the same time, her book, The Colossus and Other Poems, was published by Knopf. That summer, Plath found out for certain of her husband's infidelity. In September 1962, the couple went to Ireland to mend their relationship, but within a day or two, Hughes left abruptly. Later that month, they decided to separate legally. In October, Plath wrote over 25 poems, including Lady Lazarus, Daddy, Ariel, and more. Most of them would appear later on in her book, Ariel. In December 1962, Plath and her two children moved into a London flat in a building once occupied by William Butler Yeats. She and her children were without a telephone, and the heat was poor or non-existent during the winter, and it was one of the coldest winters recorded in history to that date. The Bell Jar was published under the pseudonym Victoria Lucas in January of 1963. By late January, she began writing more poems, poems that have been identified as Somber, Sheep in Fog, The Munich Mannequins, Edge, and others. It was cold. Her children were sick. Plath was very, very depressed. In the early morning of February 11th, 1963, Plath placed her head in a gas oven after sealing the rooms between herself and her children. She left a note for a neighbor who lived downstairs telling him to call the doctor, but that neighbor was knocked out for several hours from the gas that seeped through the floor into his apartment. By the time Plath was found, it was too late. Her gravestone in Heppenstall Churchyard bears an inscription chosen by Ted Hughes. Even amidst fierce flames, the golden lotus can be planted. The gravestone has been vandalized repeatedly by those who resent Hughes's name appearing on the stone. They've attempted to chisel it off to leave only the name of Sylvia Plath. The attempt became even more common after Hughes's partner, Asiya Wevel, killed herself and their four children in 1969. Hughes was accused in the media of everything from dishonoring Plath to battery and murder. In an article called The Place Where Sylvia Plath Should Rest in Peace, published in The Guardian in April of 1989, Hughes wrote, "My refusal to have anything to do with the Plath Fantasia has been regarded as an attempt to suppress free speech. The fantasia about Sylvia Plath is more needed than the facts. Where that leaves respect for the truth of her life and of mine, or for her memory, or for the literary tradition, I do not know." In 1998, Hughes published Birthday Letters, his own collection of 88 poems about his relationship with Plath. It won the Forward Poetry Prize, the T.S. Eliot Prize, and the Whitbread Poetry Prize. Hughes died of cancer later that year. On March 16, 2009, Nicholas Hughes, the son of Plath and Hughes, hanged himself at his home in Alaska following a history of depression. When the movie Sylvia, starring Gwyneth Paltrow, came out in 2003, Freda Hughes, who was 2 years old when her mother died, accused the peanut-crunching public of wanting to be entertained by the family tragedies. She published a poem called My Mother, in which she says, "Now they want to make a film for anyone lacking the ability to imagine the body, hidden oven, orphaning children. They think I should give them my mother's words to fill the mouth of their monster, their Sylvia suicide doll." Sylvia Plath was the author of 9 collections of poetry, including her collected poems, which won the Pulitzer, the novel A Bell Jar, and other works, including 4 children's books. Let's go to some recordings now of Sylvia Plath reading her work. The first 2 poems you'll hear are Tulips and The Surgeon at 2 a.m.
The tulips are too excitable. It is winter here. Look how white everything is, how quiet, how snowed in. I am learning peacefulness, lying by myself quietly, as the light lies on these white walls, this bed, these hands. I am nobody. I have nothing to do with explosions. I have given my name and my day clothes up to the nurses, and my history to the anesthetist, and my body to surgeons. They have propped my head between the pillow and the sheet cuff, like an eye between 2 white lids that will not shut. Stupid pupil, it has to take everything in. The nurses pass and pass. They are no trouble. They pass the way gulls pass inland in their white caps, doing things with their hands, one just the same as another. So it is impossible to tell how many there are. My body is a pebble to them. They tend it as water tends to the pebbles it must run over, smoothing them gently. They bring me numbness in their bright needles. They bring me sleep. Now I have lost myself. I am sick of baggage. My patent leather overnight case, like a black pillbox. My husband and child smiling out of the family photo. Their smiles catch onto my skin. Little smiling hooks. I've let things slip. A 30-year-old cargo boat stubbornly hanging on to my name and address. They have swamped me clear of my loving associations. Scared and bare on the green plastic pillowed trolley, I watched my tea set, my bureaus of linen, my books sink out of sight, and the water went over my head. I am a nun now. I have never been so pure. I didn't want any flowers. I only wanted to lie with my hands turned up and be utterly empty. How free it is. You've no idea how free. The peacefulness is so big it dazes you. And it asks nothing. A name tag, a few trinkets. It is what the dead close on, finally. I imagine them shutting their mouths on it like a communion tablet. The tulips are too red in the first place. They hurt me. Even through the gift paper, I could hear them breathe lightly through their white swaddlings like an awful baby. Their redness talks to my wound. It corresponds. They are subtle. They seem to float, though they weigh me down, upsetting me with their sudden tongues and their color, a dozen red lead sinkers round my neck. Nobody watched me before. Now I am watched. The tulips turn to me and the window behind me. For once a day, the light slowly widens and slowly thins, and I see myself, flat, ridiculous, a cut paper shadow between the eye of the sun and the eyes of the tulips, and I have no faith. I've wanted to efface myself. The vivid tulips eat my oxygen. Before they came, the air was calm enough, coming and going, breath by breath, without any fuss. Then the tulips filled it up like a loud noise. Now the air snags and eddies round them, the way a river snags and eddies round a sunken, rust-red engine. They concentrate my attention that was happy, playing and resting, without committing itself. The walls also seem to be warming themselves. The tulips should be behind bars, like dangerous animals. They are opening like the mouth of some great African cat, and I am aware of my heart. It opens and closes its bowl of red blooms out of sheer love of me. The water I taste is warm and salt like the sea, and comes from a country far away as health.
They are departing in their transparent garments, turned aside from the scalpels and the rubber hands. The scalded sheet is a snowfield, frozen and peaceful. The body under it is in my hands. As usual, there is no face, a lump of Chinese white with seven holes thumbed in. The soul is another light. I have not seen it. It does not fly up. Tonight it has receded like a ship's light. It is a garden I have to do with, tubers and fruits, oozing their jammy substances, a mat of roots. My assistants hook them back. Stenches and colors assail me. This is the lung tree. These orchids are splendid. They spot and coil like snakes. The heart is a red bell bloom in distress. I am so small in comparison to these organs. I worm and hack in a purple wilderness. The blood is a sunset. I admire it. I am up to my elbows in it, red and squeaking. Still it seeps up. It is not exhausted. So magical. A hot spring I must seal off and let fill the intricate blue piping under this pale marble. How I admire the Romans. Aqueducts, the baths of Caracalla, the eagle nose. The body is a Roman thing. It has shut its mouth on the stone pill of repose. It is a statue the orderlies are wheeling off. I have perfected it. I am left with an arm or a leg, a set of teeth or stones to rattle in a bottle and take home, and tissue in slices, a pathological salami. Tonight the parts are entombed in an icebox. Tomorrow they will swim in vinegar like saints' relics. Tomorrow the patient will have a clean pink plastic limb. Over one bed in the ward, a small blue light announces a new soul. The bed is blue. Tonight, for this person, blue is a beautiful color. The angels of Morphia have borne him up. He floats an inch from the ceiling, smelling the dawn drafts. I walk among sleepers in gauze sarcophagi. The red night lights are flat moons. They are dull with blood. I am the sun in my white coat. Grey faces, shuttered by drugs, follow me like flowers.
This one is called Mushrooms, and it's simply about mushrooms from their own point of view. Overnight, very whitely, discreetly, very quietly, our toes, our noses, take hold on the loam, acquire the air. Nobody sees us, stops us, betrays us. The small grains make room. Soft fists insist on heaving the needles, the leafy bedding, even the paving. Our hammers, our rams, earless and eyeless, perfectly voiceless, widen the crannies, shoulder through holes. We diet on water, on crumbs of shadow, bland-mannered, asking little or nothing. So many of us, so many of us. We are shells, we are tables, we are meek, we are edible. Nudges and shovers in spite of ourselves. Our kind multiplies. We shall by morning inherit the earth, our foot's in the door.
Spinster. Now this particular girl, during a ceremonious April walk with her latest suitor, found herself of a sudden intolerably struck by the bird's irregular babble and the leaves' litter. By this tumult afflicted, she observed her lover's gestures unbalance the air, his gait stray uneven through a rank wilderness of fern and flower. She judged petals in disarray, the whole season sloven. How she longed for winter then, scrupulously austere in its order of white and black, ice and rock, each sentiment within border, and heart's frosty discipline, exact as a snowflake. But here, a burgeoning unruly enough to pitch her five queenly wits into vulgar motley, a treason not to be borne. Let idiots reel giddy in bedlam spring. She withdrew neatly, and round her house she set such a barricade of barb and check against mutinous weather as no mere insurgent man could hope to break with curse, fist, threat, or love either. The Disquieting Muses. Mother, mother, what ill-bred aunt, or what disfigured and unsightly cousin did you so unwisely keep, unasked to my christening, that she sent these ladies in her stead, with heads like darning eggs, to nod, and nod, and nod at foot and head, and at the left side of my crib. Mother, who made to order stories of Mixie Blackshort, the heroic bear, mother, whose witches always, always got baked into gingerbread, I wonder whether you saw them, whether you said words to rid me of those three ladies nodding by night around my bed, mouthless, eyeless, with stitched bald head. In the hurricane when father's 12 study windows bellied in like bubbles about to break, you fed my brother and me cookies and Ovaltine, and helped the two of us to choir. Thor is angry, boom, boom, boom. Thor is angry, we don't care. But those ladies broke the panes. When on tiptoe the schoolgirls danced, blinking flashlights like fireflies and singing the glowworm song, I could not lift a foot in the twinkle dress, but, heavy-footed, stood aside in the shadow cast by my dismal-headed godmothers. And you cried and cried, and the shadow stretched, the lights went out. Mother, you sent me to piano lessons and praised my arabesques and trills, although each teacher found my touch oddly wooden in spite of scales and the hours of practicing. My ear tone-deaf, and yes, unteachable. I learned elsewhere from muses unhired by you, dear mother. I woke one day to see you, mother, floating above me in bluest air, on a green balloon bright with a million flowers and bluebirds that never were, never, never found anywhere, with a little planet bobbed away, like a soap bubble, as you called, come here. And I faced my traveling companions. Day now, night now, at head, side, feet, they stand their vigil in gowns of stone, faces blank as the day I was born, their shadows long in the setting sun that never brightens or goes down. And this is the kingdom you bore me to, mother, mother. But no frown of mine will betray the company I keep.
They are the last romantics, these candles. Upside down hearts of light, tipping wax fingers, and the fingers, taken in by their own halos, grown milky, almost clear, like the bodies of saints. It is touching, the way they'll ignore a whole family of prominent objects, simply to plumb the deeps of an eye, in its hollow of shadows, its fringe of reeds, and the owner past 30, no beauty at all. Daylight would be more judicious, giving everybody a fair hearing. They should have gone out with balloon flights in the stereopticon. This is no time for the private point of view. When I light them, my nostrils prickle. Their pale, tentative yellows drag up false Edwardian sentiments. And I remember my maternal grandmother from Vienna. As a schoolgirl, she gave roses to Franz Josef. The burghers sweated and wept. The children wore white. And my grandfather moped in the Tyrol, imagining himself a head waiter in America, floating in a high church hush among ice buckets, frosty napkins. These little globes of light are sweet as pears. Kindly with invalids and mawkish women, they mollify the bald moon. None sold, they burn heavenward and never marry. The eyes of the child I nurse are scarcely open. In 20 years I shall be retrograde as these drafty ephemerids. I watch their spilt tears cloud and dull to pearls. How shall I tell anything at all to this infant still in a birth drowse? Tonight, like a shawl, the mild light enfolds her. The shadows stoop over like guests at a christening.
In this last poem, The Stones, the speaker has utterly lost her sense of identity and relationship to the world. She imagines herself, quite graphically, undergoing the process of rebirth, like a statue that has been scattered and ground down, only to be resurrected and pieced together centuries later. Her nightmare vision of waking in a modern hospital gradually softens as she recovers and accepts the frightening yet necessary ties of love, which will heal and return her, whole again, to the world. The Stones. This is the city where men are mended. I lie on a great anvil. The flat blue sky circle flew off like the hat of a door when I fell out of the light. I entered the stomach of indifference, the wordless cupboard. The mother of pestles diminished me. I became a still pebble. The stones of the belly were peaceable, the headstone quiet, jostled by nothing. Only the mouth hole piped out, importunate cricket in a quarry of silences. The people of the city heard it. They hunted the stones, taciturn and separate, the mouth hole crying their locations. Drunk as a fetus, I suck at the paps of darkness. The food tubes embrace me, sponges kiss my lichens away. The jewel master drives his chisel to pry open one stone eye. This is the after hell, I see the light. A wind unstoppers the chamber of the ear, old worrier. Water mollifies the flint lip, and daylight lays its sameness on the wall. The grafters are cheerful, heating the pincers, hoisting the delicate hammers. A current agitates the wires, volt upon volt. Catgut stitches my fissures. A workman walks by, carrying a pink torso. The storerooms are full of hearts. This is the city of spare parts. My swaddled legs and arms smell sweet as rubber. Here they can doctor heads or any limb, On Fridays, the little children come to trade their hooks for hands. Dead men leave eyes for others. Love is the uniform of my bald nurse. Love is the bone and sinew of my curse. The vase, reconstructed, houses the elusive rose. 10 fingers shape a bowl for shadows. My mendings itch. There is nothing to do. I shall be good as new.
That was Kate Royal with the English National Opera singing I Have Dreamt from Wuthering Heights. Before that, you heard Sylvia Plath reading a number of her poems. And before Sylvia Plath, you heard Jeanine Cannon reading from her new book, Under the Azure, Poems of Francie Jammes, translated by Jeanine Cannon. Before closing out tonight, I want to remind you that the Sonoma County Book Festival will be back in town on September 24th this year in downtown Santa Rosa. For more information and a full schedule of events, you can go to socobookfest.org, socobookfest.org. And if you'd like to see what Word Temple Poetry Series events are upcoming at the Sebastopol Center for the Arts, you can go to wordtemple.com. I hope you enjoyed tonight's program. If you have any comments or questions about any part of this program, please contact me at khastings@wordtemple.com. Thanks for listening.